is Jack Ayer. I'm resident scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. We're here for another in a series of conversations with bankruptcy professionals in which we try better to understand the system and how they do their work in it. I think it was Frank Lloyd Wright that said they jacked up the country and everything loose slid to California. If it did so, then today's guest would have been there to catch it. Richard Kipperman likes to say that he will do anything legal with other people's money. He's worked as a receiver, as an assignee for benefit of creditors, as a stakeholder, and of course as a bankruptcy trustee, a craft he now practices through the bankruptcy court at San Diego. Richard Kipperman, welcome to ABI Podcasts.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Did I get you right so far?
So far, you're right on.
Okay. You've been a panel trustee a lot of years, isn't it?
I've been a panel trustee since 1986, just before the U.S. trustee program came into San Diego.
Okay, so coming on, as it were, 20 years. Got
it. Almost.
I always wonder, I could always think, then, when you were 10 years old, did you turn to your mother and say, Mother, I'm going to grow up to be a bankruptcy trustee?
I didn't know what a bankruptcy trustee was when I became one.
Okay. Okay. And do you know?
I think I have a better understanding.
You're a non-lawyer trustee, right?
Non-lawyer trustee, pretty much a generalist.
Okay. How did you drift into it?
Backed into it. We were trying to get into the turnaround business, and all the attorneys we talked to that seemed to be in that field said, well, we use bankruptcy trustees to do this, and so it became apparent that in order to get into the turnaround business that one of the qualifications was to be a bankruptcy trustee, and so we tried to start our firm really as a turnaround firm, and bankruptcy was auxiliary. And then as it worked out, my former comma partner, because we own 50% of a corporation, ended up doing the consulting side, ended up doing the bankruptcy side. And he didn't like this side of the business so well, so he went out and got a real job, and I love this side of the business. I stayed with it.
You love this side of the business. Can you specify? If people look shocked when you say that, what do you tell them?
I have a very short attention span, and so this business is great for that because things don't last for long periods of time normally. Things are always changing. I like the fact that when I come in the morning and start the day, I have no idea where I'm going to be in the middle of it because of the phone call that you can get of a new bankruptcy and some issues that you have to deal with. I like the art of the deal, whether it's a $3,000 settlement or a $100 million lawsuit. I like to go to the track, and it doesn't make any difference if I bet. I get just as big a kick out of a $2 bet as I do a $100 one.
What were you doing before you started trusteeing?
I had my own business. I was in business with my brother. It's an old family business that went through some rocky times, and we got turned around. And then I went to work for a construction company that was having some severe problems, and they brought me in to try to get them squared away. And I thought I was pretty good at things getting turned around, so I kind of ended up going in that direction.
How did one get to be a panel trustee pre-U.S. trustee?
Well, you do something wrong in an earlier life. I got on, in those days, we got appointed by the court system, and we were recommended by the administrators who work for the courts. I think that still goes on in two states. Submit an application, and when an opening came up, they would review your qualifications against others, and then we were fortunate enough to get recommended. We started out as a corporate trustee.
What do you got, maybe 8 or 12 panel trustees in San Diego now?
In San Diego, I think we're down to 7.
Okay. And you take a regular rota of cases, so you do what, one day of 341 meetings a month, 5 days?
What? We do about 22 settings a year, so every 2 weeks. The panel sits Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, except on holidays, and so it works out to about 22 days a year per trustee.
So what's your life been before, during, and after October 19, 2005?
I'm going to tell you, we normally, the past few years anyway, have been doing about, let's say, 1,300 cases a year. I had between the 28th of October and the 23rd of November over 1,000 cases. So from September till December, I don't recall working as many hours as I had to put in then. Of course, now I think my last three sittings have been six new cases a sitting.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that was the next question. One speculates that you could have shot a cannon up and down the halls of the courthouse right after October 17th and not hit a new debtor.
Yeah, hand grenade could have gone off, nobody would have been hurt.
Okay, but the numbers are creeping back up now, or are they not?
Right now, they're very low and holding. They're probably growing a little bit. I don't anticipate. I anticipate very slow growth in filings. I think if we look at the pipeline theory, where you pack the pipe and everything comes out, well, everything came out at once, and so now you start packing the pipe again. But people are going to misspend and get into problems, and they'll have to start filing again.
How's your real estate market?
Out here, it is soft. We went crazy for 3 or 4 years, and now, I mean, prices are holding, but they're not going up, and the amount of inventory on the market, at least according to my wife, who's a realtor, my inventory in the market is probably four times what it was a year ago.
Hmm. Maybe I should have formulated that. Who are your debtors? What drives a person into bankruptcy in San Diego County?
Our debtors are mostly just working people. Make probably, as a family, between $30,000 and $60,000 a year. Have credit card debts as much as their income is, and the only way that they'll ever get out of bankruptcy is hitting the lottery. I think that they're just people that overspend, that don't use credit cards properly. I'm sure some of it comes from medical. We always get the people, divorces, problematic, or, the question is, did the financial problems cause the divorce, or did the divorce cause the financial problems?
Right. Alan Pedlar said the two courts ought to be next door to each other for the convenience of the litigants, right?
Boy, that's for sure. But I think it's more that financial problems, create stress on a marriage and cause a divorce. But they're just, I was born of depression parents. And I think the further we get away from that generation and the lessons they learned, the more difficult it is. And I think that, television, I have a son, his wants are grow because of what he sees on TV.
We were low maintenance by comparison when we were kids, weren't we? This crowd. I guess I was thinking in that framework, second mortgages, equity lines of credit, they haven't been driving your docket to any extent yet, I guess?
No, we have not seen that yet, and I keep thinking that one of the things that's going to drive bankruptcies are the people who got these one-year ARM loans, mm-hmm. at teaser rates at 1.5%, 2%, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden they're going to be looking at 6 or 7%. And they're not going to be able to afford it. But as of yet, we haven't seen that.
Yeah, I talked to one trustee yesterday who said, yes, we've been talking about that for several years, and you know what? It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I know somebody did an article for one of the local papers, and this just came up with this the same type of analysis. Is we know it's out there, but that axe hasn't fallen. The other axe that hadn't fallen that I think is going to be a bigger problem is the fact that credit card payments double.
Uh-huh, okay. Good. You mean the increase in the minimum payment that
regulators
put through? Okay.
I gather
in large measure at the behest of consumer advocates who said they wanted consumers to be able to work their way out from under the mountain someday.
Yeah, interesting. Some of the people who are advocating for the consumers aren't doing much good for them these days.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, good. On that, the great pig that went through the python before October 17th there, do you have any read on, is it possible that a fair number of those cases shouldn't have been there at all, ever, but were panic cases that were prompted by the news reports of the coming of the act?
I think that there are a lot of people who were just afraid they'd never be able to file bankruptcy and filed. But I absolutely agree. I saw more bankruptcy cases on a percentage basis that you just looked at people and you went, why did you file? Mm-hmm. I had a person in prison, no income, no property. You know, what are they going to do? They call you and harass you in your cell?
Some entertainment in the evening anyway, wouldn't it?
Things like that, people with $6,000 and $7,000 in debt and a job that pays $20,000 a year, you figure, somehow you could make those things work. So there were a lot of people that I believe that filed just because of the press.
You say attention deficit disorder, you like to do different things. What's a trustee do? I've watched trustees some. I've never actually been one. What do you do all day?
What do you do all day? But my son used to say I read a lot. When we get a ton of paper, I figured just as an aside, when that pig did go through the python, that I had effectively 150,000 pages to go through. So I actually read all the schedules, supporting documentation, try to compare it and figure out if there's any holes in it, and go through and look and compare it to the exemptions. Now, where with the new law, where we have people filing exemptions in so many different states, it's become far more complicated. But we go through that and see if there's anything there, check the vehicle registrations against when they bought the car, see if there's any preferences and those types of things. In business, go through in depth into the finances and the checks written in the prior year and see if there are any issues. Look for differences in the schedules and lifestyle and hope somebody calls you up and says, my ex-boss didn't tell you about the Corvette.
I was going to get on to that. Do you spend much time sleuthing for assets?
Fair amount. If you look on the surface of almost all the schedules, everything's exempt and nothing has any real value. But, I wouldn't be the first trustee who got a set of schedules and said, the debtor says he has a 1990 Mercedes-Benz, and when you pull a copy of the registration, it's a 2000. Or the person who had a Dodge, but he forgot to tell me it was a Dodge Viper, and so instead of being worth $1,800, it was worth $18,000. So there is a certain amount of sleuthing. You really hope that you get a call or a tip, because you can only look so far into these cases.
Do you object to discharge very often?
On occasion. I mean, it has been my experience that the judges consider that a very draconian measure. And so I'm not going to go in there unless I have all the facts and I'm able to prove it.
Probably takes a war chest, too, doesn't it?
Well, it takes some money. And in those cases, you don't get paid anyway. But I think that we have a certain duty. And most of the cases that we've been successful on they're just outright lies. And I've had cases where if the debtor would have told the truth, they would have kept their assets and their discharge.
Okay. Do you think, I don't know if you work there locally, you may not have any basis for comparing. Is San Diego a fraud jurisdiction, or is it just just like any other jurisdiction, which is your normal routine amount of fraud?
I think that San Diego, historically, I have been told, probably has more Ponzi schemes than anybody else. I don't know. I know your comment about Frank Lloyd Wright. The other one that we hear is Southern California is granola. One ate fruits and nuts as flakes.
We've had some spectacular fraud cases down there over the years, haven't you?
Yeah, we had Dominelli.
Refresh my memory on Dominelli. You got that goes back, what, 25, 30 years now?
Dominelli was winding up just as I became a trustee, so it must be 25 years.
Yeah, yeah. J. David Dominelli, right?
J. David Dominelli.
What did Dominelli do?
Dominelli set up a Ponzi scheme. I can't remember what he was doing, if it was foreign currency trade or how he worked it, but he was paying, let's say for a number, 18 or 20% when a good second trustee was paying 10. And then he'd bring in investors and pay them their phenomenal returns with the money that came in from new investors.
We'll be back after a short break.
We pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. This week's news item looks at the Financial Accounting Standards Board proposal for companies to report their pension deficit or surplus on the balance sheet as an asset or liability. The effect will mean that many companies are going to show more debt from pensions than was reported before. A recent poll by the global accounting firm of Grant Thornton found that 87% of 122 CFOs and controllers think that companies should be required to account for pensions as the FASB suggests. While CFOs are not fazed by the proposed accounting change, financial analysts are concerned about the impact on struggling companies. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that even if General Motors is able to sell its financing arm, GMAC, and increases its assets by nearly $10 billion, the automaker could see about $68 billion in unrecorded liabilities added onto its balance sheet. Those liabilities, when applied to GM's 2005 balance sheet, would leave the company with shareholders' equity of about negative $43 billion. Not a pleasant forecast for a company fighting to stay out of bankruptcy. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
I want you to tell me again your account of the arithmetic of Ponzi schemes. Who makes what and who loses what?
Actually, that's where we got some confusion on that. I was talking about in a pyramid scheme.
Pardon me, pyramids. Yeah, I mean pyramids.
San Diego, and it was, I know it was all over Southern California, had a deal where you bring in $100, somebody brings in, and you put in $100 in a pot, and they put you actually on a pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And when you finally looked at it, the people at the top, 3% made a lot of money, 47% broke even, and 50% lost. But that was in a pyramid. In a Ponzi, you know, the first guys in and first guys out do pretty well. I've got some that were paying 18-20% plus, you know, a finder's fee and some other things. And if you got in and out at the top, you got good money on your investment. If you were one of the last guys in, you lost it all.
I got fascinated by your 347.50 number, and I asked my son about it, and he Googled it and came back and says, no, I can't find any mathematical basis for it, but it does seem there are a lot of 47-year-old victims of pyramid schemes. That's all that Google was able to tell us.
And that could be, but yeah, the Ponzi's we have out here, you know, they've been, some I believe are unintentional Ponzi schemes. They don't start out that way, they end up that way.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got the absolute pure, you know, the Dominellis, the... I have one called Pin Fund that was, I had the spinoff. I had all the investing entities. Pin Fund was a big corporation, and it got a lot of notoriety because the head of Pin Fund, spent some of his money on a porn star, and actually about $10 million of the company's money on her.
Okay. Do you have any intuition to what would lead San Diego to Ponzi schemes?
San Diego is a very entrepreneurial town. A lot of small businesses, a lot of risk takers. That could be part of it. You know, people who are willing to go out on a limb and take a risk for what they believe is a higher return. I can't think of anything else that would do it.
Besides doing the straight moving them through the tube bankruptcy type of stuff, it sounds to me like you've done some fairly extensive liquidations, haven't you?
I've had some fairly large liquidating cases where just liquidating general assets, and then I've had three major Ponzi schemes. Those are Ponzi schemes in excess of a couple hundred million dollars that I've been the trustee of, and then some other interesting cases like the San Diego Symphony.
Okay. You did the San Diego Symphony.
I did the San Diego Symphony until they finally got it converted to 11 and got it taken care of.
Okay, so you didn't get to sell all the cellos and oboes and stuff.
But actually, the only thing we really had to sell was a music library.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. The rest of it was, people seem to own their own cellos, I guess.
Sure, they're probably protected by the tools of the trade exemption anyway.
Yeah, and we did have the thing that makes noise like thunder and some of those types of things.
Oh, my.
And I could have sold you an asbestos curtain.
Oh, my. Oh, dear. You know, we don't want to talk about Ponzi's too much here, but I'm curious, what's a Ponzi scheme mean to a trustee? What's the work for a trustee in a Ponzi case?
What's the work for a trustee?
The work.
Work?
Yeah. I
think the work for a trustee is more almost forensic accounting, to go back and see where the money came in and where it went out. Is the majority of it, and hopefully you've got some deep pockets to go after to bring some money into the estate so you have some money to pay out.
Do you do your own forensic accounting, or do you outsource that?
I get it started, and then I outsource it. I find that I view myself as a trustee, and I know that probably some of the judges don't share my opinion, is that we're the chairman of the board, or maybe even the president of a company, and then you hire people who are specialists to go in and do the legwork.
Do you keep a permanent staff?
I have my own staff.
The secretary goes to work at 7:30 in the morning, it seems.
She's here at 7:30. We got people. We run flex hours in this place, so it's kind of bizarre. But staff to do more ministerial and bookkeeping type functions. The outside things, we think that we're better off and more efficient going outside to get. But the reason we're able to handle large cases is, I've got the staff to shuffle through the paper.
I see. Mm-hmm. When somebody actually has to change the padlocks, that's you, is it?
I have changed my share of padlocks. I have a very large bolt cutter that I have used, not just as a side, recently mentioning that story, we went down to lock up a shop in a relatively bad area of town, and I'm out there. There was a couple people there to watch, I guess. They were trying to buy something from one of my other bankruptcy estates, and I'm out there with a locksmith at dark, and we're cutting the locks off this building so we can get in and relock it and rekey it. Nobody ever came and asked me anything.
Yeah, I guess the related question is, have you ever been shot at?
I've been threatened.
Okay.
I fortunate enough, I was threatened once where the judge was on the same list, so I actually got somebody to do something.
He was able to take an interest in it.
Yeah, otherwise, they go, buck up.
Rottweilers, what do you carry for defense against
them? I used to have a 12-gauge shotgun in my office, but after my office was broken into four times, I decided that the last thing I need is criminals stealing another weapon in this town. So I took it home.
Do you ever run operating businesses?
I've run my share of operating businesses, all types.
It's always kind of fascinated me that my impression is that a lot of trustees just take it as an axiom that if the debtor goes into Chapter 7, the business closes down. But I should have thought that if the way to maximize the value of the assets is to run the business, you should run it in Chapter 7. Do you ever do that?
I have run a few in Chapter 7. I am becoming more along the lines of other people's thinking, that maybe even though there is a better return from running the business, because of the inherent risks involved that become personally and the lack of reward that, you know, you start to make better decisions if you just close the doors.
Yeah. Because 20/20 hindsight is easy, and nobody's going to forgive you if you lose on one, are they?
Yeah, well, people get mad because you didn't do as well as they thought you should, but you're the one that's on the hook. And then if you do a good job, what's the reward?
Yeah, well, what is the reward? I can't imagine how a trustee makes money anyway.
I told a federal judge once when she asked me how trustees get paid, and I went through the old payment scheme that I hope has changed under the new law. And I said that, you know, you get this percentage and that, but, you know, a judge can look at it and determine based on your hours and other things. So my opinion is, as a Chapter 7 trustee, you work for free and anything you get's a bonus. I do not understand the payment scheme where some judges feel that you're on a contingency fee, and using the statutory maximum. Some judges feel you're on a contingency fee limited by your hourly rate, but capped, which kind of defies logic. But, you know, we try to live and work within the system and make it work as best we can.
And I've heard it said you're in the only business where a five-year-old receivable may be good news. You might actually get paid someday.
You may actually get paid someday.
Let's see, we've talked about how you get into this. There's something else you want to ask. How does it work now? You just get a list of cases from the U.S. trustee or something? Do you open the mail one day and there they are, and you get that's your for the month?
We have, I think, as good a bankruptcy clerk system as anybody, and we started getting our cases electronically, I think, in the late 90s. And so what happens is a case is filed. Most of the cases in San Diego are filed electronically, or they're scanned in by the court. And we get the schedules and all the paperwork electronically. I get a notice. I get an email. And then through our program that we run, I get a dump every day that tells me exactly what has been filed in every one of the cases that I have. Go through and look at them and put together my my calendar, and we're off to the races.
And that's your 341 docket.
Right.
Do you learn much at 341 meetings?
If you get lucky. You know, the 341 meetings, is a friend of mine at the city attorney's office, was Coke machine justice. Put your quarter in, get your justice out. You figure you only have a few minutes of questioning for a debtor. You try, when you go through the schedules in the beginning, you can pretty much feel out where there may be some holes that you can ask questions about. 98% plus of our cases are no asset cases. So you try to, you get rid of 90 of them just pretty much out of the box. The other 10% you have to look at a little harder.
Do you let anybody else talk at a 341?
Anybody who wants to.
Oh, do you?
Even the U.S. trustee. we have, you know, we get creditors that come and ask, you know, sometimes you get really the horrible case where you have and I've had a few of these, where you have some sort of, like a big appliance company goes out of business, and you have 100 people that had deposits and never got their appliances, and maybe 30 of them will show up at the 341A meeting. And so I'll let the first 5 or 10 of them ask questions, because I figure that's the only thing they get for the money they invested. And so if we let them vent a little bit, we think that they're going to get all they got out of the investment.
And since this is enough to keep you happy, you say you still do assignments for the benefit of creditors and receiverships also?
I do assignments and receiverships and other types of cases. Chapter 7 work is fine, and when it's good, it's good. But in order to maintain a staff and feed the amount of families we have to feed out of this thing, I couldn't do it just doing 7 work.
You're making me feel guilty. I think I've held you up too long.
Nah, never.
Well, it's been fun to talk to you.
It's been nice talking to you, Professor, and I thank you very much for allowing me to present some of my side.
Well, thank you for your time.
Okay.
You've been listening to one of a series of podcasts that we are producing here at the American Bankruptcy Institute to help us all understand better how bankruptcy professionals do their work. We hope you found it helpful. Look on our webpage at abiworld.org for more podcast choices. This is Jack here saying thank you for listening.